Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm delighted to say that we're back in Northumberland, one of the most beautiful counties in England, and we're here to meet somebody who is steeped in the traditional music of this area. Catherine Tickell plays the Northumbrian pipes, the fiddle, she composes, she's worked with loads of different ensembles, she's worked with symphony orchestras even, but at her core is the music that comes out of this landscape. And she personifies the handing on of that tradition from generation to generation. And she's going to bring along her dad, Mike Tickell, a storyteller and singer who also knows so much about the culture and history of Northumberland. What a wonderful opportunity this is to learn more about this landscape and about the music that runs through it. Catherine and Mike, how wonderful to see you. Thank you very much for inviting us here. Would you just tell us where we are? Because there's a river, huge river running behind us. Where are we, Catherine?
Well, this is a little bit huger than it sometimes is. This is the River Reed, and we're in Northumberland, just not very far from my house. We've just walked down here from the house. So this is the backdrop to my life. This is the soundscape to my life. This is a tune that I think every Northumbrian piper knows. It's a tune called the Reedsdale Hornpipe, and it's part of the kind of core repertoire. It's in the Northumbrian Piper Society first tune book. The birds in the background. Love it.
The river's hugely important, isn't it, in terms of the music that it's provoked and the stories that surround it?
It is. I mean, I think with all traditional tunes and, you know, on in that traditional folk world. A lot of tunes are written, and songs are written about particular places and particular people. They're very, very specific. So I've grown up with all of that, but then also a lot of the tunes that I write are also about particular places, namely this river and other areas close by to you. And the same for my dad.
Yeah, this is the Reed, and it's steeped in border ballad history. So you've got the Battle of Otterburn just a few miles upstream. You've got the Ballad of Percy Reed. You've got Chevy Chase could well have taken place here. So the old songs are very much part of this landscape, soundscape, if you like.
Is this a good fishing river?
Oh, this is the great fishing river. This is the Reed, which flows into the North Tyne just down there. And the Tyne, as you probably know, is the greatest fishing river for salmon and sea trout in England and Wales.
Now, you've got the pipes there.
I have.
Do you need to tune up, or are they in good... Are they in
I'm
good
not entirely sure what we're going to do.
Are you going to play and perform something about a place which is not immediately here, but is nearby?
Yeah, I can't quite believe we're going to do this, because this is something we haven't ever tried to do. So there's a poem that my dad wrote about this really magical place called Holy Well Pool.
It's on the Wark's Burn, that's it. And the Wark's Burn flows in at the village of Wark, as you would expect. But we lived in the forestry village at Stonarf when I was 12 years of age, and I went down and fished at the Holy Well Pool, which is a deep, dark pool. And then at one time I heard a man tell me that you could pluck songs out of the air. Pluck them out of the air and sing them bonny.
And so that inspired the poem, did it?
Well, I tried. When I was probably about 70, I tried to pluck the songs out of the air at the Holy Well Pool, because it's a sacred place. There's a spring there as well. And I stood at the empty house and I tried to pull the songs out of the air. And this poem that I wrote, which Catherine's turned into a song, was what came out.
And so you're going to try to perform it in this is like a world premiere version, isn't it? Tell us what we're going to do.
Well, at the moment, I still don't know what's going to happen. So Dad wrote the poem, and it's a place that I've gone to all my life, you know, since being a very, very little girl. I used to go when he was fishing down there, and there is something very strange about that pool and that area. So when I saw the poem, I thought, right, I'm going to set this to music. And I did a version of it with my band, with lots of voices, and just a very kind of drony accompaniment, and actually a recording of down here with the river and the birds. So Dad is going to recite the words. I'm going to put my drones on. You've got the river.
Hang on, we've got another instrument here.
Well, when we recorded this on the album, it was kind of an afterthought. We'd finished the album and all the lads had gone home out of the band, and there was the three girls were left, and I'd written the tune for this song. I said, come on, let's have a go at it. So we did, but the rest of the band were gone. So for the accompaniment, we just did drones and some stuff from my house, making kind of percussion noises, and a couple of stones from the river that we kind of rubbed together. So I don't know if you want to...
What is this? It's just on the table here by the river. There's a sort of garden table.
I'm just going to
make a noise with it.
It's a set of Indonesian anglungs.
Anglungs? And,
I know nothing about it, but I was given them, and it's just such a watery-sounding noise that we thought, right, OK, it's from Indonesia, not Northumberland, but we don't mind. We'll welcome all the sounds.
So could I perhaps help out by...
You could.
...playing the anglungs?
You could.
What's your advice?
And if you want to... I've got no idea. Just give it a little shake. As the spirit moves you. And then there's plenty of stones down there by the river. If you wanted to get a couple of stones and rub them together.
Yes, we'll get Natalie, the producer, to have a bit of a bit of a stone.
And I will just play some drums. So, this is kind of free improvisation, Northumbrian style.
There are songs and voices by the well, in the air, by the house, but I cannot catch them. He said you could take them from the air, bring them down and sing them bonny. The lichened gateposts have had no gate this century. He said a weaver lived in this derelict house above the dark pool. They say a horse and rake
once came down from the hayfield above, down the bank, into the pool. There were rabbits among the hazels and wild garlic. The dog and I walked in the leafy darkness. I take buried holly from the quickening tree at the house front. Light candles at the empty window, in the wall space by the empty door, and wait and wait. There are songs and voices by the well, in the air by the house, but I cannot catch them. He said you could take them from the air, bring them down and sing them, Bonnie. Storyteller, piper, balladeer. He fused all languages, pulled music and song out of silence. He died in Aberdeen this year. I wait at the door with holly and light, but there is no answer. Above, a single bird floats high.
Mike, I wanted to ask you really about how the tradition works, because you are part of it. You're passing on stories and songs that you must have heard from somebody else. Did you hear them from your parents or from your family growing up?
Well, when I was 16, I worked on the Forestry Commission in Wark Forest, and I came across people who knew poems and wrote poems. Rennie Proudlock from Wark wrote poems. So he wrote about the change that was happening with the Forestry Commission coming here and planting up all the hill farms. So I've got a song or a poem that Rennie wrote. So I can remember him writing it one snowy day in the farmhouse at Ken Glasknap. And he wrote it on the bedroom wall upstairs while we were all sitting playing cards.
On the
cards.
Wall?
Yeah.
This was not a farm that people were living in, by
the way.
They were just out there.
We're planting the hill farms up, you see. So all of this area round here was once hill farming, and now it's the biggest man-made forest in Europe, I think. The biggest man-made, yeah.
And so you were picking up these stories just from people
among
you knew?
Them, yeah. Also, I started, I'm afraid, drinking at an early age, and I was in the Grey Bullet Walk, and I learned from a singer, Adam Jackson,
yeah.
So who is a shepherd.
But I think what's interesting, because you weren't brought up in a folk tradition
No.
I mean, you kind of was, but you didn't know it. I mean, you did discover folk clubs.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And we had that interaction. Sorry, there's a hen in the background.
That's all right.
Come down to visit us.
When we moved and worked down in Scunthorpe area, so I discovered the folk club, and I couldn't believe it. We were in Scunthorpe, and I heard this Scotch singer, Archie Fisher, singing one of my songs, as I saw it, The Keel to Hunt from here. I thought I was the last singer of it.
So I think, you know, for you, discovering a folk club an absolute eye-opener. It's like, oh, this is what I do. This is the music that I like. I didn't know anybody else was interested in it.
So I'm thinking about your childhood now, Catherine.
Right.
So what was going on in your childhood? Was your dad, did he sing at home?
Oh, did he not? Yes, he did. He was always singing. And I think because we lived down in Lincolnshire for a bit, he probably was maybe singing more down there, because everything he sings is from up here. Everything is absolutely intensely place orientated. It was almost like a way of saying, yes, I might be down here in Lincolnshire, but this is who I am. This is where I'm from. It's a way of kind of reminding himself. So I was brought up with that, absolutely, you know, hearing all the time these songs.
And real Northumberland stuff.
Well, that's absolutely right, because the man who wrote the book there, Wonnie Blossoms, he went out to America from Kielder here. And when he got out into America, all he wrote out was the Wild Hills of Warning and Kielder.
Because when you're away from it, I suppose, in a way, what you do is you long for it and you try to conjure it in,
well, that's
in
right.
what you do.
And these sparkling streams and the yellow trout, the bonny hills are here. But lammies will open o'er the brae, my bonny soul to cheer. Oh, bring me back, thou gallant ship, across the Atlantic fame, that I may see me wannies wild and me bonny moorland hame. That's all James Armstrong wanted.
So this is what I grew up with. You know, you go anywhere with my dad or my granddad and they're going to burst into either song or poetry or something at any
And did you
moment.
Like it? Or, you know, because some kids can be embarrassed about their parents doing performing and that kind of thing.
Mostly I liked it. Occasionally, when we'd been to the 20th battlefield, which all to me, you know, when I was about 10, these battlefields do tend to look quite similar. And Dad would be striding around going, ah, now the Scottish soldiers will come down over that hill. And can you just imagine it, Catherine? And then he would be singing a bit of the ballad and I'd be like, oh, come on, Dad. When do we get to the tea room?
It fell about the Lammas tide when the moormen win the hay. The doughty Douglas bound him right into England to drive a prey. So that's where he came in, just over the top there.
And then when I was, you know, when I was playing instruments, we couldn't go anywhere without having, you know, the instruments in the car. And then that would be the next thing, like, Catherine, go and get the fiddle or the pipes or the whistle and play the tune for Otterburn in this field.
He's a man, he's invented folk on foot before his time, hasn't he?
I think so.
Well, and listen, will you play a tune here that's inspired by the river for us?
Well, what I could do, Hersha Lynn, oh, I haven't played that for a while, Hersha Burn, it's about a waterfall just up and then up the Hersha Burn. Wild Hills is always good, but it's kind of slow.
Slow, we don't mind slow.
Okay.
The Wild Hills is the tune to the poem that the man wrote, the poem to the Wild Hills of Wanney. The book's called Wanney Blossoms, and the tune, the Wild Hills of Wanney, he wrote a song to it, didn't he? That's the Wild Hills.
So you're going to be in this.
No, I'm not. Sorry.
Go on, do a bit of the thing.
This is James Armstrong, looking back from America and wanting to be here. Oh, my heart's in the west, on yon wild mossy fells, among moorcock and plover and red heather bells, where the lambs lie in clusters on yon bonny brae, round the wild hills of Wanney, so far, far away. There's Id, Crag and Lummer, and Heppel half too, o'er Hartside and Danna, I've oft been on you, o'er Ottercaps, Hersha, and Peden sa high, and the wild hills of Wanney, forever for me. And there he is, out in America, looking back over here, and of course, he came back. Thank you.
Okay, that was a bit of a tune that I wrote called Hersha Burn, which was written for a little waterfall up in Bellingham, just over there. And then another bit, two little extracts of two tunes there. The second bit, the slow one, was from a tune that I wrote, quite a long time ago, called Reedsdale. So we're in Reedsdale, so I thought I'd give you a bit of that.
So were instruments something that you picked up at home or at school, Catherine?
Oh, at home. I always wanted to play, and my granddad Robson on my mum's side, in fact, all my mum's side, they've been around here for hundreds and hundreds of years, the Robsons, Halls, Dodds, you know, they're all very traditional names from around here. And they knew a lot about the music, but then on dad's side, there was more actual players. So my granddad Akel played the fiddle and the accordion and the piano. And when he moved into the old people's bungalows in Wark, I got his piano out of the farm because it wouldn't fit into the bungalow. And I was about five then. And I remember he'd given it to me because I used to spend hours in the front room in the farm at Willow Bog, just playing this piano. And it's actually that memory of playing that piano has very much affected how I respond to kids making a racket on musical instruments. Because I remember it so clearly. I was making pictures on this piano, and I can remember one of them was a jungle, and I had, you know, I was crashing down the bottom end of the piano, and it was elephants, and then had little high notes, and there were little zebras and things, and fairy horses. You know, I was only about five or four when I was doing this. To anybody listening, it must have just sounded like a kid being a bit of a pain and bashing the hell out of this piano. But in my mind, I had whole landscapes going on. And, there's a fish just jumped there. Sorry.
Oh, wow. It's a great day. Your rod.
Yeah, it's a great day for fishing.
It
Look
is.
At that. We've had that rain. Yeah, sorry.
A fish of it, yeah. And the fiddle, did that come next?
Yeah, so I had the piano. And then, because my mum played the concertina as well, so I was brought up with that. And then the fiddle, I was desperate to play the fiddle. You know how sometimes you think that if you really, really want to do something desperately, you assume that you mustn't be allowed to do it. It must be something bad. So I didn't tell my parents that I really wanted to play the fiddle and went into school and signed myself up for it and then came back, you know, with this thing that had to be signed saying, I give consent for my child to have free school violin lessons, which you got at that time, which was fantastic. And then the pipes, that was kind of by accident, really. It was the fiddle I was drawn to. And then Dad had a friend he played rugby with who had a set of pipes for sale, and you thought you might
be able
to...
I bought them for him, yeah, and we went up to Archie Dagg, if you remember, to buy Archie Dagg's pipes, and they're the very ones he had, those set of pipes. They were made by an old Northumbrian hill farmer called Archie Dagg, who was a composer of tunes as well, and he played the fiddle as well, didn't he?
It's a very common traditional combination to play the Northumbrian pipes and the fiddle. And in fact, my Archie pipes, I've only really played three sets of pipes in my life. So there's the Archie Dagg set, which I played until I was about from the ages of 10 to 17 or 18. But they only had a certain number of notes on them. And then there's a friend of mine in Cambridge who makes pipes. And he lent me a set of pipes while he was kind of fettling up the Archie Dagg set. They were needing their 10,000-mile service. And then I suddenly found all these new notes. It's like, ooh, this is exciting. I've got an F natural. I've never had an F natural before. So I started writing all these different tunes with them in. And on my 21st birthday, Mike Nelson, who is the pipe maker, gave me a set of pipes, which is this set that I still play. But these bellows here, this is the Archie Dagg bellows.
Oh, right. So it's like a hybrid, is it? So you've got the Archie Dagg.
It's the only set of bellows I've ever used, and they're very rough and ready. So with the bellows, obviously, you're not blowing into Northumbrian pipes. You've got the bellows strapped around your waist. And some people's sets of bellows are very kind of beautifully turned wood and everything. These are like two slabs of wood held together with a couple of shoelaces and a bit of washing machine tube.
And tell us about the instrument itself, because how is it related to the Irish pipes, which have the same sort of movement with the bellows, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Are they similar instruments?
Well, they're all bagpipes. I mean, I feel a kinship to every sort of bagpipe, you know, and players of pipes. But they're all very, very different. You know, if I got the Irish pipes, if I borrowed a set, I wouldn't really be able to get much of a tune out of them because the fingering's so completely different. Same with the Scottish. I did actually have a try this set of Scottish pipes when I was younger and fainted, so that was...
Because of all the breathing.
So that wasn't good. But one thing with the Northumbrian ones, you've got the drones here, and that just goes on all the time. But then the chanter, which is the bit that plays the tune of the Northumbrian ones, is very different to most other types of bagpipe. So as you can see, I'm just keeping the bellows going here, and the air goes into the bag, and you keep the drone going. So with the chanter, the end of the chanter is closed. So at the moment, I've got all my fingers on. There's silence coming out of the chanter. There's nothing. And you open one finger and put it back. And it's that very staccato sound. It's what gives Northumbrian pipes their particular sound. Very precise, very clear. You know, the other type of bagpipes, they have a wildness, perhaps, that Northumbrian pipes don't have. But we have something, a different sound. You know, you have
a precision.
That, yeah.
And that's a beautiful bag that the air goes into those. It looks like blue velvet.
It is. So it's leather in underneath. But yes, I've had this a long time. So that there's a little bit of lace that the pipe maker's wife, Shirley, made for me many, many years ago when I first had this set of pipes.
So, Mike, when Catherine was heading off in these directions, these musical directions, presumably you were fully supportive of all that and you thought this was a great idea, did you?
There was one day I was going into work in Gateshead and she was on the radio and the man says, your father's letting you go and do all of this and be like as if I had any control. I don't know how old you were then, maybe 16 or something like that.
And you started going into competitions and all that.
Playing away.
Yeah, in the piping world there's regular competitions that you go into and that helps you to kind of have something to practice towards. But I do think that really none of us were really prepared for what this meant. I assumed that I would go off to college or, you know, university or do something like that. And then I didn't. I decided, kind of spur of the moment, really. I was at Farnham Folk Day and somebody from Folk Roots or Southern Rag, I think it was at the time, this is a very long time ago, interviewed me and said, are you going to be taking this up professionally when you leave school? And it had never crossed my mind. And I said, yes, I am. And then thought, oh my goodness me, how am I going to tell my parents? Got home and told them and they went, yeah, all right, yeah, that's fine. As long as you work hard, you were just worried that I would actually work. But then I went off and I was solo for the first however many years. Going around these folk clubs, and at the time, I can't think of other, you know, solo, like women going around, or girl as I was, going around on their own, certainly not as an instrumentalist. It was quite unusual. And also, I was on public transport, and it was before there was mobile phones, and there were some dodgy moments.
Was it tricky for
you?
There
were some, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, I never told my parents. It's strange because, you know, my parents, particularly you, Dad, were very strict, so I wasn't allowed to go out past 9 o'clock to go to discos and things like that back in the day. But then off I went to Shetland for a week, age 13. There was one, actually, I remember almost being raffled off at this folk club, can't remember quite where it was, but I'd said to them in the interval, like, oh, could you just, who am I staying with? Because you stayed with usually the organisers or somebody, one of the residents or something. And they said, we haven't thought about that. We'll sort it out. And then they went on stage. Well, it wasn't a stage, but they went in front of the audience and said, the guest this week doesn't have anybody to stay with, so if anybody would like to put her up, just come and tell us afterwards.
For goodness.
And I was sitting there thinking, oh, this is not very good. And actually, that one, this youngish couple came up and, you know, they won the prize. They got to take me home. But they said to me afterwards that they'd never put up anybody from a folk club before. They'd only been there a couple of times. But the woman, her dad, lived in Northumberland, played the Northumbrian pipes, and she thought, my dad would like me to just keep an eye on this little girl, and I'm going to take her home and make sure she's safe. Oh. And I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah, that's
and
wonderful.
Sort of things did happen to me quite a lot, where somebody would just think, do you know, I think I'll offer to put her up. It'll be just... take her home, give her a good dinner and a nice bed. You know?
And were you conscious of being part of this tradition that your dad's talked about? Were you conscious that you were taking the tradition to a new audience when you went out on the road?
Not to start with, no. I just went and played my tunes and had a bit of a chat about the tunes, just in the same way that Dad would, or, you know, my granddad was always telling stories and stuff. So I was brought up with that, doing bits of poetry. So it was actually throughout that almost apprenticeship, those few years of playing around the folk clubs, which is an incredible apprenticeship, and I'm very, very grateful for it. It was through that that I kind of started to realise that what I was doing was different, and that it had a part to play in the folk scene, but that also it was kind of from outside that as well. It was from a different route. It's from that traditional route. And, you know, there's a whole argument and discussion to be had about folk versus traditional. To me, they're very, very different. But it's so hard to explain in what way. So I see myself as being traditional, even though my music quite often is completely out there and not
very
traditional.
Very contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
you're channeling something that comes from the tradition.
Absolutely.
In a way that perhaps a singer-songwriter who we might see at a folk festival is maybe channeling something American, or, you know, something that's not from the tradition.
It's really hard. I don't want to kind of get into that, because these things are so meaningful to people. You know, what you feel you are, I think, is important, and I don't want to question what anybody else thinks they are. But for me, I feel that tradition so strongly. And another thing, I think, for me, in the music that I write, is that I think when you're from a very strong tradition and you've grown up with it, it gives you this absolute strength. You know, you're not scared of breaking loose. You're not scared of trying something different, because you know you've got that tradition. It's part of you. You can't get rid of it, even if you try. And it gives you such freedom. And I think for a lot of musicians, they haven't got that thing that they can break away from. And it makes it so much easier.
You've got a foundation.
Yeah.
And then once you know the foundation, you can play around with the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you sing us a song, Mike,
yeah,
from
sure.
the tradition? Because it would just be wonderful to hear something that takes us back into that world.
This is out of the old tradition. This is out of the old ballads. Battle of Otterburn. It fell about the Lammas tide when the moormen win their hay. The doughty Douglas bound him right into England to drive a prey. He chose the Gordons and the Grahams, with them the Lindsays light and gay. But the Jardins would now with him ride, and they rue it to this day. You can see it's a Scots version of the Battle of Otterburn, because the Scots won it. So that's a bit out of the Battle of Otterburn. And a man who lived at Otterburn just up the road, say, living up there 100 years ago, he was a man called Billy Bell, and he worked on the roads there. So he knew the site, the Battle of Otterburn, and he was very influenced by Robbie Burns. So he would write about the show over there, Bellingham Show. So this is him coming to Bellingham Show, and he's riding along on his bike. At thick veil of mist, the Tyne Valley did fill as I crested the top of the high Ayrshire hill. I heard musical strains in the vale far below as onward I pedalled for Bellingham Show. As up through the town me old bike I did ride, the crowd was as thick as brown bees round a hive. The rich and the poor, the high, great and low, had all come for enjoyment at Bellingham Show. So they all join in on every Bellingham Show. That's how that one would go.
I'm just thinking as well, Dad, there's so that one, Billy Bell, he worked on the roads around here, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. So he was a road man.
But also just the Bellingham Show itself, you know, it's still in existence.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It hasn't been this last couple of years because of the COVID and everything.
Yeah.
And it still has a piping competition, and it's got all the sheep and
it
all
does.
Of that sort of stuff, you know, the typical shepherd's show. But for me, it's strange. So my granddad Robson, I remember when I was younger and I was winning a lot of competitions and playing in various places and, you know, I'd met minor royalty and stuff like that. And so all the rest of my grandparents were like, oh, she's doing really well and everything. Grandad Robson wasn't saying much until the day that I won. This made me cry, actually. The day that I won the piping competition at Bellingham Show. And he couldn't believe it. It was like, to him, there's nothing higher to him than winning the pipes at Bellingham Show. And I'll never forget his reaction to
his
that.
His appreciation for that meant a lot to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was,
he was so whooping.
Yeah. He couldn't even speak. He just was like, hello, hello. All he could say was hello when he saw me. He'd be like, hello. He didn't even come to listen to the competition. I don't think he wanted to see me lose or something, you know. But, yeah.
Oh, that's a wonderful memory. What an amazing memory. So are there still people now creating stories and songs in the same way?
David McCracken would write songs and poems. He's a farmer up here.
There's maybe not as many of them.
Not as many, no.
It's not as much part of the way of life as it used to be.
As it was.
So people are doing it in a more... they're more aware of trying to write this stuff. Whereas I think Rennie and those people, they were out on the forestry, you know, if you're planting up and you're... They would be out so far away that they had to be kind of dropped off on a, would it be a Monday morning and picked
well,
up and
they snowed up. That is what happened. The snow came in when we were planting at this place called Cairn Glasnup, and we went inside. And the poem that Rennie wrote on the wall was, on the hills that once echoed to the curlew's wild cry, there'll be trees that are endless in rows far and wide. 'Tis fareweel to the sheep and the shelter and stell and the canny-haired laddie that lived on the fell. And it's all changed. And he ends up with, what have they done to the wild rolling hills? The sheep and the cattle are leaving the fells. The shepherd, he walks with his Gabian dog and he treads the same path that his father once trod. The hill farms, they are dying, and the folks all but gone. Of Kate's house in Clintburn, there's left scarce a stone. And the green and harelaw stand empty and decayed, like cairns for a people and a life passed away. To many this planning has done a great wrong. This land was once peopled, it had life, it had song. But the pipes, they are played, the pipes still and cold. The poems are all written and the tales are all told. Rennie could see it dying.
There's such a wonderful image about the cairns for the people, the ruined houses being the cairns for the people.
And he was actually writing that in one of those kind
of
empty farmhouses.
Planting it up.
But he's writing it, I suppose, because you're out there, there's nothing else to do. You know, there's a couple of lads out there, you know, waiting to get out and plant the next day, just camping out in there. Right.
So we were sheltered from the storm, and one of the lines in his house, where your granddad was living at in Kate's house.
So one of the things in the poem there, my granddad Robson was living in that farm. There's nothing left of it now.
Gone down, we pulled it down in the forestry. No, it didn't.
It had a well, you know.
The spring,
So the poem is, in a way, a lament for a way of life that's being lost.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Rennie would sing in the Grey Bullet Walk. There's a recording of them singing at New Year, and I don't know how many different people were singing, probably 15, 20 people all singing. That was when the first tape recorders came out. Now, we couldn't do that.
But there might be two or three.
There'll be two or three.
Right.
Yeah, there will definitely, yeah.
Do you know, I'm not going to play what I was going to play. I'm going to play something completely different. I've just... it's funny when you're out here, you just suddenly think of something that you wouldn't play inside. And I'm hearing the birds and the breeze and the river. And there's a tune that I wrote quite a few years ago now, for a friend of mine, a percussion player called Bruce Arthur, who his whole life was about air moving and the way, you know, and that it's that makes the sound. It's the air moving on the instruments. So the tune's called Air Moving. Okay.
A little round of applause from the hen at the end. Catherine, it's really interesting because we've been talking a lot about place and the effect of place on music, but it was interesting that you just decided that you wanted to play that because it felt right in the moment.
Yeah.
So does place have that effect on you too, that you can be in a place and feel, you know, that the change of direction, the change of musical direction, that the place has an impact on you?
Yeah, and not just place like this. I don't know if other people do this, but playing the house in, you know, if somebody moves house and you go and pipe the house in for them. I've done it for a few of my friends and family. And it's interesting because I never go in with a fixed idea of what I'm going to play. And you go into one room and it's like, oh, this seems to be this tune. And then you go into another room and it's a different tune. Yeah.
So when you headed into the world of, I mean, I think you did some formal music exams, didn't you? Grade 8, piano.
On the piano and the violin, yes. I did. Yeah.
And then, but then you headed out into the world and you became a collaborator with all sorts of different kinds of musicians. And did you feel that taking the tradition to them and the way you approached music needed to adapt to different kinds of musicians that you met, classical musicians maybe, or rock musicians? Did you have to work in a different way?
Certainly. Working with classical musicians, and when I was first writing for classical musicians, I was just beside myself thinking, you know, that feeling of, am I allowed to do this? You know, will they see straight through me and think, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about? So it took a long, long time, and some musicians that I was working with, classical musicians, I remember the Schubert Ensemble of London being particularly supportive and going, look, you have a voice, and whatever you're writing, it has your accent in it, and that is a really special thing. And that meant a lot to me, because I think to start off with, I was trying to almost minimise the traditional, the folk, the Northumbrian, and trying to write something that was from their world, which was absolutely the wrong thing to do. And then going to work with Sting, you know, that was the first time I did that. I was just, what on earth am I going to play? I only play in F.
What did he say to you?
Oh, he was fine. Sometimes he'll have a very strong idea what he wants. Sometimes he'll just say, oh, just play something, see what you come up with. But, you know, with an instrument like this, it has, with the Northumbrian pipes, it has limitations. You can only play in certain keys. You can only have the drones in certain keys. It's only got certain notes. You know, if I'm reading music, I'm a transposing instrument, all of these things. And you can't really go, Sting, it's in the wrong key for me. Can you just change it? Can you do it in F instead? Pet. No. You're a Geordie. You can just do it in F. Go on. So that was kind of scary, but you eventually... I think now I'm much more like, this is the way the instrument is. This is what I can do. This is what I can't do. And also just having that confidence in the instrument, in the tradition, in what you do. It takes a long time to, or it took a long time for me to build that up. And I know that those limitations of this instrument, they're not limitations. They're things that funnel you in a certain direction. So, for example, with the fiddle, there's far less limitations. You can play anything just about on the fiddle. And almost it's like there's too many options. I don't know which way to go. Whereas this instrument, it pushes you and you can feel yourself being driven to strive for more and to strive to go deeper, to go further with this.
But isn't it wonderful that an instrument with the history that this has should be heard in the context of the most contemporary music now, and that you've taken it onto stages that are, in a way, ensuring its survival, ensuring that it's going to reach generations for the future?
I don't think, personally, that any of those collaborations have much to do with ensuring the instrument's survival, because the instrument will survive and the tradition will survive no matter what I do with it and what collaborations I might happen to do. That's the beauty of a tradition. You cannot, you know, if I do something which is really counter to the tradition that people hate, then nobody else will play it and that'll just be quietly forgotten and the tradition will just continue. Undeterred by my efforts.
Mike, do you worry about the future of the tradition? When you say there are fewer people now writing in the same way that the older people used to do, do you worry that there's any threat to it, or do you think in the hands of people like Catherine it's going in new directions?
I think it is going in new directions, but I worry if it in the local sense, where it came from, it isn't as perhaps as strong as it used to be. This is what has happened. So it's spread. So it's different. But that's what you would expect, yeah. Wouldn't you?
I think there is that thing of the way the traditional music works in my head, as opposed to the folk music, is it's much less about the actual tunes and about the actual songs. It's about the communication with your community. It's about that connection and what it means to be playing those tunes in those places to those people. And it's reciprocal, you know, it's not just me playing to them, it's them communicating and connecting with me and the place of music in the community. Like it used to be, the music was so important because it played for the dancers, and the dancers were so incredibly important in these little tiny communities, and that isn't there anymore. So it's very, very different now.
So you've got the fiddle out now.
Yes,
Catherine,
I have.
What are you feeling inspired to play for us?
If I wanted to impress, of course everybody wants to impress, and you know, you want to play something really virtuosic and make everybody go, ooh, she can really play that fiddle. But no, I'm going to play probably one of the easiest tunes I know. One thing that has changed for me through lockdown has been finding myself really drawn to those tunes that that I knew and that I played as a child. And I don't know whether it's because the future's uncertain, so you're kind of going back for some sense of comfort or safety. I don't know if it's that or because we haven't been able to travel very far, so you're kind of holding tight to the things that you know inside you. But this tune, the Warkesburn Waltz, I've played it as long as I can remember, but I've never played it on stage until this last couple of gigs, you know, in between lockdowns. It's not fast, it's not flashy,
it's one that it's very important in my family, particularly my mum's side of the family, the Robsons. So it was my granny's favourite tune. I played it at her funeral. I remember being in the pub in Wark and playing this with my Uncle Alan when he was still alive on his accordion, and my daughter joined in too, and that was like, that was very, felt really special. My granddad Robson was a champion waltzer. He always used to win the waltzing competitions. And so waltzes were very important. So this is so old fashioned and just, you know, you can think back to, it's like going back in time with this tune.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been absolutely amazing to hear your music and to hear your stories. Catherine and Mike, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure on such a good fishing day. Look at that.
Look Go and get your rod and we'll get out there.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah, the Atlantic salmon are coming up as we're standing here, coming up the reed.
Catherine Tickell and her dad Mike in Northumberland. If you've enjoyed this episode and you've enjoyed the stories and music that you've heard, you can learn more if you sign up for Folk on Foot on Film, which is our glorious archive of more than 100 songs and pieces of music that we've recorded on our travels. It's only available to our patrons. If you'd like to become one, just go to folkonfoot.com and click on the Support Us button. We rely entirely on contributions from our listeners to keep this show on the road, so every penny counts, and we'd be very grateful for your support.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. budget, mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.